back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into football season around here, but that will not stop us from talking about citizenship and local stuff and local people. We put this Baltimore Positive project together a couple years ago to bring in new voices and hear from people. Now, we've heard from her brother many, many times as he ran for mayor here. All of our WNST Wise conversations brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. And Don, I know you're gonna enjoy this one the most because we say Wise conversations. We love when we invite people smarter than us on, right?
Oh, and we definitely did that today. One of my very favorite people, and Chris Vignaraja, the CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, and let me see, Yale Law, Oxford Scholar in International Relations. Yeah, Nestor, I think we checked that box. Smarter than we are.
I'm in over my head today. You know, your brother warned me that we were, you know, having you on, that we would raise the level of debate here, Chris.
You upgraded with the Vignarajas, huh?
There Absolutely. We did. We went uptown with the Vignaraj. Chris, welcome to Baltimore Positive, what I hope will be the first of many, many visits.
I hope so. Thanks for having me on. Really,
if he liked you that much, you'd have been on 3 years ago. I just want to let you know. So I'm going to roll him under the bus right now.
I'm going to take this personally then.
Oh my goodness. Well, hey, Chris, before we're going to talk a lot about the work that your organization is doing, which is just so amazing. But before we do that, since this is your first time, obviously I'm very proud that you're a Woodlawn High grad. Introduce yourself to our listeners and sort of your background and growing up in Woodlawn and your mom and dad and where this incredible Vignaraja commitment to service came from.
Sure. Yeah. And I think it'll also be a good segue into, well, you know, why I'm working on immigration as well. So my family fled a civil war in Sri Lanka when I was very young. So I had no kind of decision-making authority at that point. I was 9 months old. And
so that's you to say fled a civil war. I'm not going to let you just say that. I mean, on this show, when somebody says, well, my family fled a civil war and they just move on. No. I just went to Antietam last month. Tell me a little bit about that, because I never really asked your brother about that, because I'm sure seeing that through your parents' eyes, like my parents saw polio and World War II.
No, I appreciate the question. So, you know, it's interesting because when I was in high school at Woodlawn using Juno, like the dial up, right? I would like to say I'm not egocentric, but the first thing I did was I just typed in Krishanthi. And just to give you a sense of kind of what we left behind, even now, if you type in Krishanthi, the first several entries will be about this girl. She's slightly older than me, and she's part of the ethnic and religious minority, just like my parents were. And she was in high school, coming back from school, stopped at a military checkpoint. And because she was part of the minority, she was detained. She was gang raped, murdered, and then dismembered. And no one heard from her. Her family then followed, tried to figure out what happened. So her mom, her brother, and then a neighbor, I think her father had passed away, went looking for her. And they were also stopped at the military checkpoint, killed, dismembered, and basically buried in a shallow grave. And so, you know, I know when I think about what would life have been if we had stayed in Sri Lanka, if my parents hadn't had the volition and the courage to leave, you know, she went to the same school that my aunts and uncles, my aunts went to, an all girls school in the north. And that's why, you know, when I think about the luck that my family has had, the good fortune that others unfortunately don't. And I guess why I'm so different is because I could have been her, right? She could have been me.
Well, we see these immigrants at the border every day. And, you know, I know there's a whole political persuasion to send these people back to be murdered in their homelands. Anyone, my people came from Venezuela. My father, you know, came here in the 60s. That's why I'm here. And obviously my life would be a little different in Maracaibo right now, probably over the last 20 years for sure. So the vilification of people leaving horrific circumstances to come to America for that Statue of Liberty to find a better life, I find it very confusing. You know, the last 20 years, what immigration and thoughts of immigration have become in this country that was built by immigrants.
Yeah. Well, and this is where there are definitely a lot of pain points, and I'm happy to kind of get into just the ridiculous fear mongering and way that immigration's become so politicized, not just in the last few years. I mean, the truth is, it's been for decades, right? The O'Meara part of my name comes from Colin Patrick O'Meara, my husband, nice Irish Catholic. And, you know, when the Irish came over, there was, you know, criticisms of I feel like every demographic that's come. And yet, you know, speaking here from Baltimore, from our headquarters, after Ellis Island, Baltimore was the town that received the second highest number of immigrants. And it was part of our strength, right? So for us, our connection was that my dad got a job as a Baltimore City public school teacher. It was the superintendent of the Baltimore City Schools who had the investment, right? The personal investment that he found us, the basement apartment in Edmonton Heights that we moved into. It was a vice principal of the school. He taught at Edmonton High first, who literally helped us move into that apartment. He's the one who helped us, you know, start a bank account. It was neighbors who walked my dad to Route 40 to explain the public transportation system, right? And so that's Baltimore. Yeah, of course, there's lots of people around here who are, you know, white nationalists or nativists, and we can talk about kind of that underbelly too. But, you know, in 1980, when we came, fleeing kind of those desperate circumstances, it was Baltimore that welcomed us.
You remember 1980, Mohler, don't you? It was almost right around the time we met.
I do remember.
So, I mean, it doesn't feel that far off, Civil War and these awful things happening in other places that changed your life and led you to this, right?
Yeah. And that's where, you know, for me, I love sitting here, you know, looking over. So if I look this way, I'm looking at the Inner Harbor. If I look that way, I'm looking at Southern, you know, before it became Digital Harbor, where my dad taught for years. And it's, yeah, I mean, for me, it's about kind of giving back. I realized that, you know, I went through John and Cake Middle and then Woodlawn High, as Don mentioned. And then I had a chance to go to some really great schools, but coming back home was really important to me.
I think about how well it would have turned out had your family moved to Dundalk. You know, had you gone to Dundalk High. I always tell Theroux that too. You know,
Chris and Theroux would have still made A's. Chris, talk a little bit. Again, we are with Krishanti Vignaraja, the CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. One of my favorite stories, both you and your brother tell a very similar story. So therefore, I'm sure it's very, very credible, but you guys would be done your homework too fast. You'd be getting straight A's. And your dad's comment was, that school must not be hard enough. You go upstairs and study some more. Am I capturing that pretty accurately?
Yeah, although I think I was the second child, right? So they were probably not as focused on the studies thing for me. So what ended up happening for me, and it's a crazy thing, but I give a little bit of credit to Woodlawn and my teachers, in the sense that because I'd be done my homework and, you know, classes weren't as demanding, I poured myself into like mock trial and tennis and soccer. And as a result, I actually think that it gave me the space to be a little bit more well-rounded in a way that, you know, my career has been law. It's been management consulting for a little while. It was the federal government, you know, working.
You've done enough serious stuff as an adult. I hope you had some fun as a kid, right?
Well, Woodlawn High School, you mentioned, was it Jay? I won't forget. I can't remember his last name. I should. But they were legendary in mock trial, right? With a legendary coach.
Yeah. David Boyer. I want to give him a shout out if I can, because, you know, he poured hours and hours after school. It's kind of embarrassing, and I'm sure Nestor is going to tease me about this. But, like, yeah, we'd be there until, like, 8 or 9 practicing. And
maybe it was good that you went to Woodlawn. We didn't do that in Dundalk. That's not what we did in Dundalk. Maybe you turned out better. Maybe I should have gone to Woodlawn. I've never admitted that. Don't.
She was happy as a Woodlawn warrior. So all of this preparation gets you, and Chris knows I've chided her along with others, and it's not that she's not doing very important work that we're going to have her talk about. But Chris, you ran a dynamic, out of nowhere candidacy for the governor in the state of Maryland in 2018. I mean, it was the little engine that could. Talk a little bit about that experience, what you took away from it, and I'm hoping you'll never say never to a future run down the road. But talk about that experience and what you learned. First time I met you was up in Western Maryland, where you electrified a Democratic meeting up there at Rocky Gap, and you just blew everybody away. I can remember leaning over to my boss and I say, "Well, boss, top that one." You were dynamic. Talk about that experience.
Yeah, so I had an advantage in the sense that I was carrying my daughter, so it was like the dynamic duo up there. This was on the heels, right, of the presidential election being won by Donald Trump, and I went out there talking about my experiences of working in the Obama administration for 5 years, serving in the White House. The devastating loss I can tell you about the day after the election, walking right back into the White House, and it was that eerie silence in D.C. But on the one hand, I was proud of the fact that we are a strong democracy and we didn't have military, vehicles ensuring the peace. People understand that there was going to be a democratic transition.
That was then and this is now.
I know. That's exactly right. I mean, that's where I think it's important to stress that, elections are won and lost, and it should have the same result, which is people accept and validate election results as legitimate. And that's democracy at its best. But in any event, walked into the White House and it felt like a funeral. I mean, people were sobbing. And some of it was the junior staffers that, were on my team, who they'd never known another president, right? They'd known the Obamas for 8 years. And so I had a lot to say about what happened in the election in the last few years and the role that citizens can play. I didn't have a lot to lose because I wasn't running for office. I was just trying to speak truth. And I guess it resonated. So people started coming up to me and they said, why aren't you running? And I said, well, it looks like I had a basketball hidden under my shirt. And I said, well, I can't see my toes. So that's probably a good explanation that speaks for itself. But then I thought about it and I thought, you know what? That's also a really good reason to run because, my daughter's now 4. And I worry deeply about the world that she's going to inherit.
Can you imagine when you were carrying her that the last 4 years, what you would have known then that you know now, based on what we've seen, this war on truth? I don't know what else to call it. I told Don, I was out in the Midwest this week with a mask, a Ravens mask, by the way. Maybe they were offended by that if they were Chiefs fans. But it really is an incredible message at its heart about democracy, voting rights, immigration, all of these issues where when I was in the Midwest, I saw guns, NRA shirts, anti-immigration and no masks. And it's just sort of like the messaging we're getting in this country right now is disturbing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's disturbing because there used to be a space that was bipartisan, that was kind of a protected class, right, which is children. And the truth is, whether it is kids on the southern border being separated from their parents or our children who didn't go to school for some time, right, last year, because people would rather listen to fiction rather than fact and question basic science. That's where I worry. Like when we think about America as the leader of the free world, how are we, kind of the home of the brave when we can't be courageous enough to do the right thing for our own kids?
I saw the number. We're 38th in the world at getting our people vaccinated.
I mean, it's just literally insane. I know we'll talk about it probably, but I imagine that because of breast cancer, I will, at some point be eligible for a booster shot. And I said to my husband, I don't feel like I should take the booster because if I could guarantee some other person, getting their first shot. And he was like, that's not quite how it works right now. Right. And I think that's what I grapple with. Right. We have such privilege here in our country, and that's where people need to get passports. Right. They need to go out in the world. They need to understand the circumstances that your family friend and my family friend fled, because I think maybe we'd have a little bit, maybe that would knock some sense into people.
Well, Chris, you did mention you're very public, and it's one of the things that you and Nestor and Nestor's wife, Jen, is a two-time leukemia survivor, and they made a decision number of years ago to be very public about it and try to enlighten folks about leukemia. You made a similar decision, hoping to help other women. Talk a little bit about that moment when you're, and again, it's so personal and necessary, when the doctor says to you, Chris, I got to talk to you, and take us from that moment and then how you fight it and how you help other women get through.
Yeah, appreciate it. And it actually connects on to your previous question too about, you know, running for office. At the Western Maryland Summit, you know, a little part of what stuck in my mind was seeing this poster board, and it was eight men up there as the gubernatorial candidates. And I think sometimes it is just so critically important to have that diversity on stage because you have a different perspective. And so for me, you know, I realized that I have a little bit of a microphone, right? From having been that one woman who ran in the governor's race, to, you know, being the only female CEO of a national resettlement agency now. And to the extent that I can use that to shine light on issues that don't get as much attention as they need, it's felt like a real privilege and a responsibility for me. So during the pandemic, I remember feeling a little bit of a bump, and I remember the doctor calling my OBGYN, canceling my annual because of the pandemic. But I mentioned that I felt this little lump. And she said, okay, well, we'll put an order in for a mammogram. But I was like, well, if it's not safe enough for me to go in for my annual, I'm sure this is no big thing. I'll worry about it once we come out of the pandemic. And thank God, 2 weeks later, I wake up with this just very forceful thought in my mind. And I'm like, I should just get it checked out. And of course I go in, and it turns out that I can, you know, even though they hadn't confirmed it, the face, my radiologist's face, I could just tell that something was really wrong. And I had scheduled this in between a series of meetings. You know, no one came with me. I was floored. And then as I went through the process of, I had basically a prophylactic mastectomy, because I could have had a lumpectomy and opted to kind of go with a more extreme route just because of my age and having the certainty of taking strong action. I learned things like 1 in 8 women get breast cancer, had no idea. I learned that if you're an older mom, you know, I had my daughter when I was 38, that puts you at risk. And so I just, you know, I figured for my own sanity, being rolled into the OR by myself because of the pandemic restrictions, you know, Hopkins understandably wasn't letting anyone come in, that if I could use my experience to educate people, and then selfishly, what I found is that when I talked about my experience, the outpouring of support, you know, high school friends who went through a similar experience and never had talked about it themselves, staff who, when I announced it at the all staff, who decided to then go get a screening. And a couple of them actually found things that, thank goodness, were nothing. I just realized that there was a benefit that people could hopefully experience from my own, you know, pain and experience. And then just the cocoon of love and prayers and support that I got, it was just amazing. And I really do think it accelerated my own healing.
Krish Vignaraja is our guest on Baltimore Positive, along with Don Mueller, telling stories about the immigration. And we get into deep thoughts here from time to time, but you get up every day and work on behalf of people less fortunate, and maybe people just like your parents or just like you when you were a little girl. Talk about the daily work that you do right here overlooking the harbor. If I would have known you were this close, I would have just invited you over. We sat together here. We'd have figured it out. We'll do that over a crab cake at some point on the early crab cake tour for sure. I have Brandon Scott next week's joining us at Coco's, by the way. We're going to be at Nacho Mama's in Towson this week. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. But tell me about South Baltimore and what you're doing from here that really has a global impact, right?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. So I run Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service. So we are a national nonprofit. We're not an arm of the church. I'm actually the first non-Lutheran head. We are the largest faith-based national nonprofit dedicated exclusively to issues of refugees and immigration. We're headquartered here in Baltimore, right across the Maryland Science Center, right on Light Street. And we do everything from refugee resettlement. So when we talk about our Afghan allies, so these are the interpreters, translators, drivers who worked alongside our military in the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. That's that kind of work. Happy to talk a little bit more about that because Maryland's actually going to get more than 1,000 Afghan allies in the next few weeks, in the next several months. And we had a donation drive just a few weeks ago. Amazing. I mean, room after room, floor after floor, filled with diaper towers, school supplies, household appliances. People were just incredibly generous. An Afghan veteran who lives here in Baltimore came in and donated gift cards. We had a pastor drive from Roanoke, Virginia to our headquarters just to donate a carload of stuff. So we'd love to, you know, get people more involved because we've had more than 47,000 volunteers from all across the country, almost 5,000 from just here in Baltimore and Maryland want to help. And we could absolutely put you to work. But we do everything from that to working with unaccompanied children. So providing mental health services. When you talk about the southern border, there is quite a number who actually come to the Baltimore, Maryland region because so many sponsors, you know, parents, guardians of those unaccompanied children are here and we reunite them with their families. So happy to talk about our transitional foster care program for people who want to open up their homes and their hearts literally to these children. Two other programs like economic empowerment. So we work with companies all across the country. We're actually launching two amazing programs here in Baltimore in the next couple months. I would love to come back and talk about them. One is our welcome centers here in Baltimore and then New American Cities. So the theory is, you know, just as I talked about how Baltimore was, you know, had an infusion of entrepreneurship and diversity early on, right, in terms of that first flow of immigrants, I think Baltimore has a real opportunity. As we're talking about the, you know, decline in terms of city population, well, there's a lot of immigrants who are facing the affordable housing challenge. And to me, this is a great opportunity to get them to come to Baltimore.
Chris, you man, there's so much there, and we are going to have you back. But you touched on a question that I get a fair amount, and that is, you use the number 1,000 that Maryland will get roughly, I guess, 1,000 Afghani immigrants. Give us what I always call like the four dummies summary of soup to nuts. You get a list, I'm assuming. I'm not even going to put words in your mouth. I want you to walk us through it.
But yeah, I'm wondering, like, these people show up at the airport. What happens to these people?
Yeah, what happens? That's the question.
I mean, I don't even – probably your family, when they came here from Sri Lanka, that day they landed, and what happens to them the first week or two or three probably defines the yellow brick road they go down, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. Great. So I'm going to take the example of the Afghans. They are representative in some ways, but there's also some unique circumstances. So they were evacuated by military planes, right? They went to third countries. They went through additional extreme vetting. You know, I don't want anyone worrying about, oh, well, here come the Taliban terrorists. They go through biometric, biographical checks, intel, Department of Homeland Security, CIA,
is
FBI.
It different than 2001 where these people came over here and learned how to fly planes? And I would think 20 years later that we're probably getting better at this part,
right,
of
exactly,
who we allow.
Right.
Unless it's Maria Butina coming from Russia, then we let her in. But I would think that the vetting system that this country would employ would be incredible 20 years after 9/11.
Exactly. Right? I mean, and you know, this is not a new program. So LIRS has resettled almost 10,000 Afghan special immigrant visa holders since the program began in 2009. No incident whatsoever involving any of these folks. Because bear in mind, right, like they worked alongside our U.S. soldiers or they worked in the U.S. embassy. So either we know that.
Or they backed up and left their country. They left their continent to come here. They want a better. They brought their children. They want a better life is what they want.
That's exactly right.
I don't see that enough on the news. I don't hear that from typical Americans that say, my people came from Poland. My people came from Russia. My people came from other places for what we have here in America, not to destroy America.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And so what happens is they go, so they'll be on the military bases for a little while. They come into communities, right? They'll show up at BWI. And we will pick them up at the airport. We'll have found an affordable apartment for them to move into.
They don't speak a word of English, right?
So it's interesting. So maybe about a quarter of them do, right?
Okay.
So because they served as interpreters and translators, right? They worked alongside the U.S. military in many of these cases. For others, they were gender rights activists or they were civil society leaders. They were championing American ideals.
They're the exact people that would be killed if they stayed where they are.
That's exactly right. In fact, they are targeted by the Taliban for retribution precisely because they were American allies. So they show up.
Traitors in their world, like literally, right?
Exactly right. They believe that girls should get an education. Imagine that. And so they show up. We find them an apartment. We even stock their fridge with culturally familiar foods. We furnish the apartment with some modest furniture, thanks to donations and volunteers who spend the time. Like, this is time intensive. Then we help them. They get their employment authorization documents at a time when, how many storefronts here in Baltimore have the, we're closed a couple days a week because of job shortages. It is a great time for these people. They're resilient. They're driven. They're ambitious, right? The two questions I get from them when I've met with them so far is, one, can we do anything to help the family that we left behind? They left siblings. They left parents behind. Who are being targeted?
Every one of them, literally every one of them, right?
Yes. The Taliban are targeting them because they're going door to door saying, "Oh, do you have a daughter who's in the U.S.? Because we heard that you had a daughter." So these people they're hiding, right? They don't have access to the bank accounts. Food's running out. I mean, it's pretty dire. And then the second question they ask is, "I want to work." I met with a couple. The father's a doctor. The mother is a gastroenterologist. At a time during a pandemic when we could use some healthcare workers, these are the kinds of people we're talking right about. We need to get them back into the workforce. And what he said to me was, in the last 20 years, I haven't been unemployed for a day. I used to give out humanitarian assistance. And so it is tough for me to take it now. But if I can just get a little bit of support, just to get, my sea legs, I will sprint. And that's why we're there to support them, right? So we help them get their kids enrolled in school. We try to connect them with employers who are so eager to meet with them, right? We navigate the legal services. It's a really awful immigration process. And I think there's bipartisan consensus around that. We're shooting ourselves in the foot, right? When you compare us to China, China went from a one-child policy to now encouraging 2 and 3 children. The U.S. has the lowest birth rate since the census began, right? That's what the latest census data showed. We're not an authoritarian regime, and so people want to still come to our country. And we're hurting ourselves by trying to close our doors and build border walls.
Boy, Chris Victor Rogers, our guest. Go ahead, Don.
I was going to say, what a message. I think a phrase my mom used to use, I don't know if it's politically correct or not, but she'd say, "Man, you're doing the Lord's work there." I mean, it's really... really, really important. I can imagine our listeners tuning in and going, "All right, I want to help." I can almost hear them in my ear. "Don, ask Chris how we can help. Where can we find? Where can we send donations?" So this is your minute, Chris, to tell folks how they can get involved with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and help you make a difference.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So we will take everything from Pampers to prayers. So if you go to www.lirs.org, so www.lirs.org, if you go to the Take Action tab, we actually have a drop-down box and you can specify if you have skills, if you have stuff, if you have, anything that you want to share and join us in this effort. We really could use your support, especially
there it is, Donna.
Now.
Put it up on a screen for you. Asylum seeker,
awesome.
Immigrant, refugee, human, co-sponsorship, help Afghan refugees and allies, volunteer, advocate, engage your community, or donate today. So right there. It's all at lirs.org. Four letters. Very easy. I like that.
Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on. Do you eat crab cakes? Is that like part of?
I love them.
All right. Well, that's good. So we do the Maryland Crab Cake Tour each and every Friday. We move it around the Beltway. At some point when I get back down into South Baltimore, which there are some spots within 6 blocks of your place that allegedly Captain Frank's amongst others that have some crab cakes that we're going to get out to on behalf of the Maryland Lottery. But it's been a great visit with you. I think the real story here is your brother's never going to come back on the air again with us because we're going to invite you on instead.
So. Well, I'm thinking, you know what, Nestor? We need to get Team Vigneraja, the
For
ruined
crab
Chris,
cake?
At Fadley's. We'll have the Team Vigneraja.
Oh, I love it. We could trash talk online.
I'll wear my Dundalk High jacket. You bring your Woodlawn Warrior stuff. We'll duke it out.
I'm not letting you get out of here. Somewhere down the road, you're a young lady. Potential. You haven't ruled out politics, have you?
I haven't.
Okay. That's what we want to hear.
Except when it's me. He doesn't want me to run for anything. So this is offensive to me, Mahler. It's fine. Chris, it's great having you on. WNSD.
Hey, Nestor, yeah. Hold it. Nestor, before you let her run, hey, tell us one thing we should all know about Michelle Obama.
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh, gosh. She is ruthless when it comes to SoulCycle. So I know I told you about how I was pregnant. So this was probably the hardest part of my job as her policy director. So during the week, we would go to SoulCycle, and she would always... her bike would be behind me, just to the right. And she was just a force to be reckoned with. So I always was like pushing myself, you know, at long hours, a little bit out of shape, but I knew that I would rather die than embarrass myself in front of Michelle Obama. And the last time I did it was after we left the White House. And when I was very pregnant with my daughter, I'm sitting in the back row, 'cause I'm like, I got an excuse here. And it's interesting because it relates to your question about running for office. And I remember we were in this class and the SoulCycle instructor said, at the very end of the class, you're enough, you've got this. And I think I must have been very hormonal, but I was like, she's talking to me and she's advising me on whether to undertake this gubernatorial run. And I was like, yeah, I am enough. I've got this. So I don't know if she knows, the instructor, how much impact she had on me, but, if you didn't like me running, blame her. If you did, thank her.
And if you run again, we'll get her on the bat phone. All right. Chris Vicnarajah joining us here. LIRS.org is the way to get involved, with all the work they're doing right here in Baltimore. You know, so good that I almost wish Dundalk would claim you at this point, both of you. But, you know, and I figured Fadley's is literally halfway between Dundalk and Woodlawn. So that would be like right in the middle.
That's right.
So we will do that. Chris Vicnarajah, great to have you aboard all of our WNST and Baltimore positive conversations. Powered up by our friends at State Fair and our friends at El Guapo and the Beaumont. We had Evan Brown on last week. Make sure you're going out there. And I'll be doing some crab cakes with the mayor next week down at Coco's in Laurelville. We've been trying to put this one together for 6 months. It will be Friday at 3 p.m. We're moving it back about an hour, which will give me an hour to do more city conversations. We'll be at Coco's in Laurelville. All presented by our friends at the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. I am Nestor. Our Wise Conversations, all brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. I had the $6 signature crab cake last week. You can check that out at BaltimorePositive.com as well. We'll get back to sports, I promise. Luke is in Owings Mills, making it all happen here during football season, all brought to you by our friends at Royal Farms. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We never stop solving problems and talking Baltimore Positive.